Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Dell, and AVU Technologies. Now here's your host, Ward Morrow.
Today we'll be joined by AFGE Public Policy Director Jackie Simon and Local 1812 President Tim Shamble. You'll also hear Jason Fornicola's interviews with AFGE 11th District National Vice President Jerry Swanky and 10th District Women's Coordinator Fredna White. Welcome back to Inside Government, Jackie Simon.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk a little today about President Obama's pay freeze for civilian federal employee workers. What's up with that?
As far as explaining why it's happening, that seems to be beyond my comprehension. I don't know why President Obama is really doing this. It doesn't make even a measurable dent in the deficit. And, of course, cutting the deficit is the worst possible thing anyone could do right now in the midst of what is still a very weak economy and 10% unemployment. But anyway, here it is, and it's going to be voted on possibly today.
And you know, you've got all these small businesses out there, restaurants, things like that. If federal workers aren't getting any kind of pay increase, and in fact, with the health care costs going up, it's actually a pay cut. Aren't small businesses and the economy going to hurt through this?
Well, I think, you know, the best answer to that question, the fairest answer, is the size of the federal employee pay raise is so small that it's not going to canceling it. Hurts individual federal employees. Will it, you know, weaken the economy further? Maybe in a neighborhood that has a high concentration of federal employees. Mostly it's just a symbolic hit that will hurt families of federal employees. That's basically it. It's just a mean gesture that will do nothing to appease his enemies and will cause hardship for many federal employees and their families, especially people who are in the lower grades.
And what is the signal to middle-class Americans everywhere? I mean, we're talking about giving tax cuts to the uber-wealthy who are billionaires who clearly don't need it, but you're taking it away from federal employees who are out there working, keeping America safe. Is that a signal to the private sector as well?
Well, I hope not, but it sure sounds like one. And it's shocking. I mean, who becomes president in order to go backwards and accept a lower standard of living for the population of the country? But that seemed to be the message in that very strange press conference that President Obama held, where he said, well, everybody else is moving backwards, so we should too. I don't quite understand it, why he would want to preside over the decline in living standards for the middle class, but he seems to say, well, let's join the race to the bottom. Everyone else is going backwards. We should, too.
Do you think there's some ways we can reduce the deficit without making the middle class foot the bill?
Well, there's lots of ways to reduce the deficit if that were the right thing to do. Without touching the middle class. And, of course, that's what we would support if the economy were growing and if unemployment weren't 10%. But right now, any kind of austerity measure is actually the exact wrong thing to do. Focusing on the deficit is the wrong thing to do. The whole hysteria over the deficit is a sort of a media fabrication that was manufactured certainly by the Republicans and very conservative Democrats, in many, many polls prior to the election, the voters placed the deficit at the bottom of the list of their concerns, rightly so. And at the top of the list of their concerns were jobs and wages and health insurance costs. But nobody wants to focus on those things. They've whipped up an hysteria over the deficit, which is absolutely not the economic problem right now. The lack of jobs is the problem right now.
So in your opinion, this really won't significantly reduce the deficit. Is that right?
Not at all. It's idiotic to pretend that it does.
So why do you think
President Obama should know that?
Why do you think President Obama decided to do this?
Well, as far as, you know, I can tell, it was a decision based on polling. It's popular with independents and other people who have abandoned the president, and he thinks he can win them back by harming his base and the middle class. It doesn't really make any sense to me, but apparently the kind of polling they do shows that people who abandoned the Democrats in the last election but had voted for Obama previously have sort of bought into this idea that federal employees are overpaid and that this gesture would be meaningful to them.
And, you know, I remember early on when the administration got sworn in, they were all talking about how to make public service popular again and make
cool
people want
again.
To go into public service. How does this impact the government's ability to recruit the best and the brightest for federal service?
Oh, I think it basically completely cancels out all those efforts. I know a number of people right now who are considering leaving federal service, certainly before any the next shoe drops and he cuts federal retirement, and others who were considering joining the federal government who now say, you know, why would I even consider an employer that A, would freeze my pay for 2 years, and B, obviously, you know, uses the federal workforce as a pawn and obviously President Obama is getting exactly nothing out of it politically that's positive.
You know, with unemployment being over 9%, I mean, I know the counter argument would be that, you know, in terms of competing with the private sector, that there may be folks, if people leave government service, that would be happy to have the job. But in reality, aren't we really competing with a private sector where they're getting back to giving the big bonuses to the people at the financial institutions and the higher-ups that are, you know, as well-educated as federal employees?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if, you know, we're competing exactly in the same labor market as investment firms are for you know, people who are going to be eligible for multi-million dollar bonuses. But I do think that, you know, the combination of the pay freeze and some of the other proposals that are in the Deficit Commission report, like going from high 3 to high 5 for calculating federal pensions, creates an enormous incentive to retire for anybody who's eligible to retire. In the meantime, the Deficit Commission also says they only want to hire 2 for every 3 who leave. And, you know, with that same old idiotic phrase, do more with less. But we all know that the reality is people do less with less. And I think we've seen all too many consequences of the federal government being starved for resources, with the oil spill, with the financial crisis due to failure to implement regulations or even write regulations. You know, we've had the mine disasters, we've had food safety recalls, we've had one thing after another that can only be prevented in the future if we have adequate resources in our federal agencies whose missions are to protect the public from these kinds of problems.
And let's talk about the FEHPB enrollees. Are they also at risk under all this?
Well, I mean, you made reference to the fact that, you know, federal employees are going to not just be, not stand still, but be actually worse off as a result of the pay freeze, because obviously there's no freeze being either proposed or implemented on what the health insurance companies can charge federal employees for health insurance. And I might add, there's no freeze on pay for the government's contract workforce. But the worst thing we could talk about with regard to FEHBP is the proposal in the Deficit Commission report that would change FEHBP into a voucher program, where you just get, instead of having a percentage of the premium paid by the government, they just give you a cash voucher. And that cash voucher would be adjusted each year by less than the amount that health insurance premiums go up. So it would shift more and more and more every year of the cost of health insurance coverage onto employees. That's a truly disastrous proposal for federal employees.
Yeah, let's talk about this for a second. A cash voucher, I mean, would it be a set amount?
Yeah. And the idea is, the proposal in the Deficit Commission report is to adjust it annually by the percentage growth in GDP plus 1%. So, for example, if it had been this year, GDP grew by about 2.5%, so you add 1% to that, 3.5%. So your voucher would go up by 3.5% when health insurance premiums on average went up by more than 7%. Well, guess who would have to pay the difference? the federal employee.
Well, and let's talk about this with a voucher. I mean, obviously, if you have a good, healthy year and you don't see the doctor very much, I mean, okay, fine. But let's say you have to have an organ transplant or something. I mean, if you spend more than your voucher amount, you're just out of pocket?
Oh, well, no. The voucher, presumably, would be used to buy health insurance. So let's say you're in Blue Cross Blue Shield, standard option. You'd still be buying health insurance, okay? So the only difference from year to year, regardless of your health status, would be the amount you'd have to pay for the premium.
So you just buy it on the private market?
Yeah. Well, I mean, presumably, you know, the government OPM would still do its annual negotiation and deliver a price and a package to federal employees. It's just that instead of the government paying around 70% of the premium, each year that voucher would buy, you know, a smaller and smaller percentage of the premium. 65, 60, 55, 50. It would just go down and down and down as a percentage because we'd be stuck with a cash voucher amount that would be growing slower than the premium would be growing.
And have you gotten a lot of feedback from AFG members? I mean, I know a lot of us around the country have been hearing from our membership on this, and people seem to be absolutely outraged.
You know, there's lots of reactions. Shock, outrage, just incredulity. No one can understand what's going on, why he thinks, you know, he's appeasing a bully, these bullies somehow, by offering us up as a sacrifice. It's just no one can believe it, and everyone understands what small potatoes the you know, price of the pay raise. I mean, after all, the canceled pay raise was only 1.4%. It's you know, a little over $1 billion annually that they really saved. They say they're saving $2 billion this year and $3 billion next year. We'll see. I think it's smaller than that.
And as we come into our last minute, are you finding that really part of the outrage is that if it was a shared sacrifice, I mean, if the billionaires had to pay their taxes like they were supposed to, and you know, everybody was somehow asked to give a little bit, but it seems like it's just balancing the budget on the backs of federal employees. Is that right?
Anybody would be forgiven for having that impression. The timing of simultaneously freezing federal pay and caving in to the tax cut for the millionaires and billionaires is just too much for anybody to bear. It's galling, it's insulting, it's outrageous, it's irrational. It's just wrong on every possible level.
And it's time for us to pause for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at insidegovernmentradio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees, looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Save 10, 20, even 30% on PCs from Dell. Only Dell can offer AFGE members the guaranteed lowest price through their member purchase program. Visit Dell.com/AFGE for details.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I've been joined by Tim Shamble, president of AFGE Local 1812, the voice of America. Welcome to Inside Government.
Thanks for having me.
So, being an AFG local president and a federal employee, what are your thoughts on President Obama's pay freeze?
Well, I'm not really happy with it, and I don't think most employees are. I think most employees feel, first of all, most federal employees feel, hey, we're willing to do our part. You know, if this is what it takes to reduce the deficit, we'll do it. But we should only be asked to do, you know, a part, not carry the whole load. And I think a lot of Americans, not just federal workers, but most working Americans feel that, you know, we're being asked to pay for the mistakes that Wall Street made.
And, you know, as you think about this, how it will actually impact you. I mean, everybody thinks that this will just impact the budget. But as you know, a person who gets a paycheck and has a family and that sort of thing, what cutbacks will you need to do in your personal life to be able to absorb this?
Well, as a federal employee in Washington, D.C., first of all, we had a transit subsidy, which is going to be cut back. We're also facing higher gas prices right now. Everything seems to be going up in costs. So we're going to cut back on our spending. We're going to be forced to do that. So that's going to hurt not only us, it's going to hurt the economy. I don't understand. You know, they said that this is going to help reduce the budget, but when you look at the numbers, it's maybe help reduce the budget by 0.03%. What it's going to do is hurt the economy. People aren't going to have the money to spend. We're not going to have the extra discretionary money that, you know, will help get the economy moving again.
So if you're a small business owner, this could really, especially in an area where you've got a lot of federal employees, say a VA hospital area, military base, D.C. area, I mean, this is going to impact small business in a big way.
Yeah, it'll impact small business. It'll impact large business everywhere that you know, there are public federal employees, I should say, federal employees that are, you know, working. It's going to affect the economy in those areas.
And what would you like to see the president do differently? What, instead of this, what would have made more sense?
Oh, I don't know if I can offer the president much advice on that, but I think we, you know, we were a target, an easy target. I think outside, you know, the Beltway, it's easy to scapegoat federal employees. I think it was just an easy mark for him, and he didn't get anything in exchange, you know, by you know, freezing our pay. I guess it made him look, you know, good, like, you know, he was willing to have the employees under him, you know, make some sort of sacrifice. But I don't know what he could do instead of that. You know, first, well, you know, he could have fought harder to eliminate the Bush tax cuts for the upper 2% in this economy. That would have made a bigger impact. He could have, I don't know, you know, used the bully pulpit to, you know, reduce some of these outrageous salaries and bonuses for bankers and Wall Street traders. You know, maybe tried to get some of the money back that came out of our pockets to bail out these firms. There are things I guess he could have done instead of, you know, this little public relations gambit of freezing our salaries.
I know I was at the VA in Baltimore City yesterday, and I was doing some recruitment for new members and talking to people. And the impression I got from AFG members, and share with me whether at the Voice of America you're seeing this too, folks coming up saying, look, if, you know, the budget's in a situation and we have to do this, at some point when there's shared sacrifice, maybe we could consider it. But first, you can't be giving tax cuts to the mega billionaires. You can't have the private sector giving out these huge bonuses again and then come to us and say, hey, you know, there's no money left in the kitty and you're going to have to tighten your belt. When there's plenty of money on the table with these mega billionaires, that these tax cuts, even Bush, when he did them, said they were going to expire. So, you know, everybody knew they weren't going to continue. What's the need to do that in this time of austerity?
I think that's the general sentiment all over with federal employees. Yeah, there could be plenty of money left, you know, if these tax cuts for the upper 2% were allowed to expire. And then we wouldn't have to be taking the hit that he's proposed that we take. And it looks like we're going to do it. I mean, it's not likely the Congress is going to reverse that. Yeah, it just doesn't seem fair. And as a federal employee and most public sector workers, we're willing to do our part. I mean, we're a pretty patriotic bunch. And if that's what's required, we'll step up to the plate and do it. But I think where we're really, you know, angered by this is that we're the only ones that are being asked to sacrifice here, and that just isn't fair.
And how will the federal government compete with the private sector if they can't offer a competitive compensation package? I mean, I'm thinking as people retire and you know, you're trying to get the best and the brightest, It's going to be very difficult to do that if the private sector is offering these, you know, uncapped bonuses and things like that, and the federal government's got a pay freeze.
Yeah, well, that's exactly true. You know, the president had issued an initiative to hire the best and the brightest and to, you know, try to speed along the process of hiring people into the federal government. Then he announces a pay freeze, and then he announces a hiring freeze. So that seems contradictory to his goal that he, announced earlier in his administration. I don't understand that contradiction at all. You're not going to get people. Why would anybody want to get hired into the federal government if there's going to be a pay freeze, if they had another option? They're not going to do it. It's not the best opportunity for them.
And you know, one of the things they've been talking about in terms of personnel reform, both in the last administration, really, and this too, is trying to reform hiring and make it easier, faster, more flexible. But they're trying to do all this in a time of a hiring freeze. It seems to me, whatever your job is, whether you're at the Bureau of Prisons, whether you're a Border Patrol officer, whether you're working at Voice of America, if they don't fill jobs, that means the work doesn't get done, right?
Well, I think everywhere in the federal government, I know it is true in our agency, we are understaffed. And they just keep asking employees to do more and more and more. And I guess that's going to be the situation again, or we're going to have to cut product. There's no other way around it. You know, we're pretty much bare bones now at the Voice of America. And, you know, they've not been hiring a lot of people, except in the higher grades, but not for the people that are actually producing the product that we're supposed to produce. It's getting tougher and tougher to take on all the additional responsibilities you have when, people leave and they're not hiring behind them. And now it's going to be even more difficult. I don't know how, you know, the employees are going to be able to do it to keep up unless they reduce, you know, what we do, what we produce.
And, you know, with the baby boomers getting ready for retirement, I mean, they're going to want their Social Security checks. I'm guessing they don't want a 20% longer wait until they get them. I'm assuming the veterans, when they come back and want their VA benefits, don't want a 20% longer wait until they get medical care and get the pay that they may need. I'm assuming Voice of America, I mean, how are you guys going to get your product up and on the air if you've got 20% less folks doing it?
Well, that's a problem. I guess what they'll do is cut some of what we're doing. If not, I mean, they're just going to burn out employees. We're not going to be able to do it. And that's a shame because, there's all sorts of problems around the world that, you know, we'd like to reach out and talk to people in foreign countries and let them know, what's good about America and the ideals of democracy and liberty. And we're not going to be able to do it.
I mean, when we're talking about these kind of cuts, I mean, you're really talking about very, as you mentioned, very patriotic group of folks. I mean, when you're talking about people that are down there on the border trying to guard it, when you're talking about the civilians that get deployed into, hostile situations, I mean, you're talking about people that are willing to put their lives on the line. When you hear some of these people talking about how they've got to cut the budget to have tax cuts, I mean, freedom isn't free. At some point, you got to pay for some of this stuff. Are you finding that your members are really, I guess, looking at the union as needing to stand up on this because this is important for all of them?
Yeah, they want the union to express their views that, hey, we shouldn't be the only ones sacrificing. And they want people to know that, federal employees aren't just, paper-pushing bureaucrats. It's true. Federal employees, there are people, at the Department of Defense, they're in Afghanistan that are, in Iraq that are in the line of fire. They are putting their lives on the line. And, of course, the Border Patrol officers on the border, they're under fire sometimes, and they're protecting our borders. It's not just, bureaucrats, which is the opinion I think a lot of people have outside the Beltway, and that's unfortunate.
Do you feel the message is getting out?
I think with the corporate media, it's hard to get the message out there. I think the unions are doing the best that they possibly can. I think it's getting out there to a certain extent, but we don't have the coverage that we really need. And we're not going to get that coverage with the corporate-owned media.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, did you know you have free access to all federal government job listings at your fingertips? Through AFGE's partnership with AVIEW Technologies, you can view all available jobs, apply online, and be notified when a position of interest to you becomes available. View your application progress online 24/7. You'll even get information to make you a better job applicant. Simplify your next career move with AVIEW Technologies. Log on today and check out current job openings at afge.us. That's www.afge.us and click register.
Some polls say Americans don't trust government. But listen to our members, the real people who work hard for you every day.
I'm Mike Schnobrick, a correctional officer at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. Trust me, the terrorists are locked down tight.
My name is Janet Winghart, a Social Security claims rep in Fort Lauderdale. Senior citizens can trust me to get them the right check at the right time.
I'm Michelle Reed, a registered nurse at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. Trust me. I care for our veterans like family.
My name is Everett Kelly. I work for the Anniston Army Depot, Anniston, Alabama. Trust me. Our tanks are tough.
I'm John Gage, president of AFGE. You can trust us. We work for you. Brought to you by AFGE and online at afge.org.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at insidegovernmentradio.com. We've been joined by AFGE 11th District National Vice President Jerry Swanky. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's good to see you, Jerry.
So we have you here today at the VA Council's 20th Triennial Training Convention. Tell us a little bit about what you've seen so far.
Well, a lot of excitement this morning. The election for the officers of the council was, of course, today, and they just announced the results. So there's about two-thirds of the room that's really happy and one-third of the room that's kind of quiet. Everyone's getting along great, though. Great opportunity for everybody to get together and chat.
Talk a little bit about what they do here at the convention. I know it's a big focus on training and education.
The training and education, I think, is really something that's an ongoing thing, and I really believe the most important part of labor education in particular is it's less of a academic environment and more of a casserole bake where the students coming from the different and varied backgrounds, different departments that they might work in, kind of bring that wealth of experience into the classroom and digest the concepts and talk about best practices and ways that the whole room can kind of learn from each other and collectively go out of that room with the strengths of everybody in that room in terms of their experience and have really our best thinking as an organization going forward. And this is a great opportunity to do that.
Sounds a little bit like the old saying, you learn more on the playground than you do in the classroom.
More on the playground. Well, when the playground is the classroom, I think, is the key because our people work hard and play hard. And I think the more that we can kind of confuse those two kind of concepts, I think it keeps people energized, first of all. It keeps everyone's morale up a whole lot higher. And anytime you can make learning fun, it just kind of creates that competitive environment where everybody really wants to do their best.
Yeah, they do a great job of that here. And like you said, it's they've really focused on education and almost year-round. They're always doing something to train and educate their members.
A constant concept. And I think it's really not that unusual for people in the medical environment because occupationally, institutionally, that's really a it goes to the core principles of the mission of the agency in terms of the medical and psychological health of the veterans group. So it's really endemic to the way that they've always thought and do their jobs.
Talk about the education piece for a minute from a labor-wide perspective. How are we doing? And maybe give us some examples of some tactics that we're implementing now or maybe some that you would like to see implemented.
Well, I think our whole education program has really been gravitating to more and more of an interactive process where they're kind of tapping the collective experiences of the group and trying to make the academic point or the curriculum point. The efforts that we've made towards getting some college credits and getting a lot of the experience out in the field into an accredited program where our students, leaders, officers, activists can pad their, I shouldn't say pad the resume, but collect those environments to transcribe onto a resume and get it counted towards college credit is important, not just from an individual self-growth opportunity, but creates a situation where they can advance themselves and grow into the agency and hopefully get promoted or earn greater responsibilities with the agencies, and most certainly make the VA a better place to work and do so with better and more trained and more educated employees.
Yeah, it seems as if when you look at the VA Council as a whole, the more educated the members are, the more effective the group is going to be as a whole, and that would go for any council.
Absolutely, and consequently, so does the whole constituency of the VA. The veterans themselves as patients, the families of the veterans as their own family members go through their health care, and the more that we kind of create those conversations between the employees of the and the mission of the agency along with the families that are seeking the health care, I think it's just building a better government at every step along that way.
Now talk for a minute about our nation's veterans. As we know, of course, we're engaged in battle in Afghanistan and had been for some time in Iraq. But a lot of times when those veterans come home, they slip through the cracks or maybe are not cared for as they should be. And talk about that for a minute and the importance of taking care of our veterans.
You know, one of the real tragic stories of our nation's history going back to the revolution, to be honest with you, has really been the lapses in often cases what has been our ability to deliver on the commitment that we've made to take care of their health care needs. And I don't really need to talk a lot about the distant past, but in terms of, you know, what we're facing and confronted with two wars still going on and literally over 200,000 soldiers deployed overseas, the real challenges that are confronted with the VA healthcare system, they lay ahead of us. And, there's been a lot of Iraqi soldiers that have returned. There's been a lot of Iraqi soldiers that have returned, done 6 weeks at home, and then turned around and redeployed back to Afghanistan. And what I'm getting at here ultimately is even though we've done better at funding some of the appropriation cycles and moving to a two-year budget, the greater challenge is about funding the VA, making sure that we've got the resources to take care of our commitments. It lies ahead of us. I mean, we're in for some real big challenges as those soldiers return home, in part because not just because of the numbers, but also because of the nature of the illnesses that many are coming home with. I mean, there's statistics out there showing that the infantrymen, for example, are experiencing as many as 6 and 7 concussions and the soft tissue damage that's resulting with a lot of the IED kinds of things that are happening. It's not immediately diagnosable, and it's a whole lot more nuanced in terms of trying to identify the behaviors and symptoms that these returning soldiers are going to be dealing with. A lot of challenges lay ahead, that's exactly why we need to be better educated, more in tune with what's happening all over, so that as a group, we can learn from everything that's happening out there.
And you made a great point there, because, as you said, some of these injuries are not immediately noticeable, which you think, knowing that there would be stronger efforts on more continuous care and keeping up with those veterans so that they don't slip through the cracks and come home and maybe appear fine, but then 6 months later or a year later or 2 years later, or even 10 years later, they're having problems that are directly related to their service but not been diagnosed as such.
That's exactly right. And the real challenge with respect to that is not just the notion of raising it to the attention of the management and the higher level leadership of the VA agency and the secretary and the administration for that matter, but it's also a case where we need to empower the veteran service organizations through our communities and really starting putting pressure on those politicians and those other, whatever you want to call them, that are getting in front of the microphone saying how much they support the troops but are not funding the VA medical system consistent with what they're saying on that byline. And this country is just full of Chinese yellow ribbon magnets all over these foreign cars being driven around, people really thinking that they're making some contribution or they're really supporting the troops, when the fact is we need to be paying attention to how every single member of Congress, how every single senator is actually voting on these issues, because that's not a partisan issue. You know, it really has got nothing to do with politics. It's got everything to do with taking care of the soldiers that keep this country safe.
And on that front, when we're talking about alerting the public or alerting members of Congress on Capitol Hill of these issues, how do we go about communicating that message to the public to the press, to members of Congress?
Well, you know, it's a complex thing. It really starts with education. That's the key. And to the extent that we can involve our own members that are members of veteran service organizations in carrying some of that message out to our communities and meeting, for example, with editorial boards of local community newspapers and talking about some of these things and really even doing simple things like having a conversation with a difficult brother-in-law who's maybe opinionated about things at Thanksgiving dinner table and telling him the facts about how that funding is done in the process and how many people we've got that are the nurses, for example, that are walking on wards in charge of, I've heard as many as 24, 26 patients at a time. And the American public just really doesn't know that. The families of the veterans know that. But to the extent that we've actually been able to integrate that message in terms of an overall concern, I don't know that we've yet been able to articulate that. We're trying to get there.
So it you're saying really that it's going to come from a true grassroots movement to be able to start even within your own home, within your own family, talking to people about things, getting it to your local press, getting it to your local representatives.
Well, that's exactly right. It's a cliched term to say that all politics is local, but this is certainly the perfect example of it. And it doesn't get any more local than one's own family.
You touched on another really good point when you mentioned the low staffing levels and the tremendous amount of pressure that those in the VA healthcare system are under to care for all of the patients, you know, and having so many at one time and being under a lot of stress in that way. I mean, even here today at the training convention, there's a program designed specifically for maintaining your stress levels and, a wellness seminar to take care of yourself under those stressful times. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think it's true that you can't really look out for somebody else if you're not paying attention to what's going on yourself. And the particular danger, I think, with employees dealing with an awful lot of stress is that, you really tend not to be looking at the nuanced symptoms that you may be interacting with at a clinical level with some of your patients. Because as employees that are trying to respond to numbers that may be forced down their throat in terms of their managers or supervisors wanting to moving so many patients through in a given hour as opposed to the quality of care that's actually being delivered, that's a classic kind of a conflict, I think, in any business or service organization. But the key here is that this is a function of the United States government and the oath that our employees take to make sure that those things are committed and promised and delivered to those veterans. That's something that's not just on a slogan. It's not just a soundbite. It's something that these people believe in every day.
They're here for a reason, and it's not to make millions and millions of dollars. They're here to serve their country. They're here to do meaningful work, and they're very passionate about it.
Extremely passionate. There's a high concentration of former veterans that work for the VA, and there's not one. I've never met anybody that worked for the VA that didn't, really believe that they were serving the veterans in ways that is really satisfied at the heart. They're, as you said, they're not doing it for pay, and they're certainly not doing it for profit. They're doing it because it's what they feel needs to be done.
And so where do we go from here in terms of communicating a message and making sure that the word is getting spread?
Well, I think to the extent that we can do more things that encourage people to sign online petitions, for example, and can speak out to the congressmen and senators and make that phone call about why are you not voting in ways that support the veterans, and asking questions through the employees and the representatives at the hospital about some of the decisions that are being made with respect to staffing. All those things collectively are eventually going to get the elephant eaten, so to speak.
As we're coming down into our last minute, what are your final thoughts? What can we expect from you, from District 11, in the months ahead?
Well, I'm really excited about our members trying to reach out and do more with the veteran service organizations. There's so many things that are different about, as a culture, the veteran service organizations that are popping up now, Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, votevets.org. There's so many very progressive veterans organizations that are out there doing an awful lot of positive things. You see them taking policy issues and aggressive stances on things like our energy policy overseas, and that's not the kind of thing, the kind of far-reaching peripheral thinking and action that typical veteran service organizations have done. And it has an awful lot of people questioning whether or not that yellow ribbon really is supporting the troops or whether or not there's a whole lot more to actually living the support of the troops.
AFGE 11th District National Vice President Jerry Swank. It is always a pleasure having you on the program.
Thanks, Jason. Appreciate it.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at insidegovernmentradio.com.
Attention AFGE members, did you know you have free access to all federal government job listings at your fingertips? Through AFGE's partnership with AVIEW Technologies, you can view all available jobs, apply online, and be notified when a position of interest to you becomes available. View your application progress online 24/7. You'll even get information to make you a better job applicant. Simplify your next career move with AVIEW Technologies. Log on today and check out current job openings at afge.us. That's www.afge.us and click register.
Save 10, 20, even 30% on PCs from Dell. Only Dell can offer AFGE members the guaranteed lowest price through their member purchase program. Visit Dell.com/AFGE for details.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Fredna White, AFGE's 10th District Women's Coordinator. Fredna, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Jason.
It's great to see you again. We're here at the 20th Triennial Training Convention for the VA Council. What have you seen so far from the convention?
I have seen quite a few of fired-up delegates, AFGE activists, members from all across the nation, and I am so proud, so very proud to be a part of this organization and this council.
And what are some of the sessions that have been going on here this week?
We've got some very good training going on. For instance, future trends in labor management relations, labor history, courses for Title 38 employees that work in the Department of Veterans Affairs. Mm-hmm. We have master agreement, better known as contract training. We have quite a few really good training classes that will equip our AFGE activists and members who are attending this convention to go back and really do the work that we need to do on behalf of federal employees.
And how powerful is that to send these members home to their districts and locals, equipped with the knowledge and information to help them succeed at the workplace?
Well, you know, Jason, knowledge is power. Mm-hmm. And when we have the knowledge, the ability and the knowledge to do what we need to do on behalf of our workers, it makes it a really good situation for us. We have to know what we're doing. We have to know the regulations. We have to know the agreements, the master agreement, the contracts. We have to know all of the things that, the tools that we need, and just to ensure that we have good working conditions for employees. We're not asking for anything to be given to us as federal workers. All we're saying is we are giving an honest day's work, and what we want is honest pay, a decent pay and wages, because, you know, workers' rights are civil rights. Civil rights are workers' rights. And in order to do what we need to do to care for the veterans, and I'm speaking of that particularly because this is the Council of AFGE Locals for all of the Department of Veterans Affairs AFGE Locals, we take care of the veterans. That is a very, very important thing, the most important thing that we do. That's the number one priority. But in order to do that, we want to be treated fair. We want to be treated, have equal opportunities. We want to be treated as a decent American citizen who is doing a service for our government, for our veterans who have earned that right. It's not a privilege. It's something that the veterans have earned, and they deserve to be given the highest quality of care. And with us having the knowledge of having to do what we do to care for the veterans, we also have to have the knowledge to be able to be equipped to ensure that the things that we sit down and talk with management about that's going to make a better workplace so that the VA can be an employer of choice.
As we take care of the veterans, many of the employees at the VA are veterans themselves.
You're absolutely correct. Many of the employees are veterans, and coupled with that is the fact that those of us who are not veterans have been touched, our lives have been touched by veterans. For example, I am a retired VA employee. My husband, who has been deceased for 9.5 years, was a 100% service-connected veteran. My brother is a veteran. So all of us are connected in some shape, form, or fashion, connected to a veteran. So we know what we need to do. We have that compassion, and we need that knowledge to continue to do that, to give our veterans quality care.
Talk about the need to really care for these veterans when they come home and not allow even a single person to slip through the cracks.
It is an awesome task, but we are committed to ensuring that no veteran is left behind. It's so very important. And with the Department of Veterans Affairs being the largest healthcare facility organization, if you will, we have that certain special characteristic that is necessary to take care of the veterans. I'm not downing private sector, but there have been, since the elections last week, there's been a lot of talk about privatizing the VA. Come on, give me a break. To privatize the VA would be such a bad thing to do to our veterans, because private hospitals, private medical facilities do not have the expertise or the knowledge or the really deep knowledge about veterans in order to be able to care for veterans.
And let's talk about some of these workplace rights. You know, Title 38 is a big issue in getting collective bargaining rights for some of these employees. Tell me a little bit about what that means for you to see that through.
Well, let me just give you an example. A lot of the opponents of Title 38 employees having full collective bargaining rights, they're of the opinion that if you are, quote unquote, unionized and have the ability to have collective bargaining rights, that you're not a good employee. But let's go back to 9/11. We're all quite familiar with 9/11. Those firefighters, unionized firefighters, unionized police officers, unionized emergency medical technicians, paramedics, being unionized had nothing to do with whether or not they were going to do their job. In fact, being unionized made them be more concerned and more intent on ensuring that they did do a good job and what had to be done. And it had nothing, it did not stop what they had to do in order at 9/11. We're all familiar with 9/11. And that same concept goes with federal employees who are unionized under Title 38. They're going to be better nurses. They're going to be better physicians, better clinical practitioners, because they know that in strength there's numbers, in numbers there's strength. So what we're doing when we join together and collectively is just to have a voice in our workplace. It has nothing to do with whether or not we're going to do our job to the best of our ability. In fact, we're going to do it better.
And let's be clear with these VA workers, and then, of course, with the firefighters and anyone who serves in the public sector, whether it's at the state, the local, or the federal level, they're there for the mission to serve. They're not there because they think they can make a boatload of money doing what they do. They're there because they love their job, they love their service, and they love the commitment, right?
Absolutely. And contrary to some of the feelings out in the general public, we're working for the federal government. And let me tell you, Jason, we will not become millionaires working for the federal government. We will not ever become millionaires. As a retired federal employee, you'd be surprised what my quote-unquote pension is. But I managed to live off of it, and I continue to do what I know is the right thing to do. So we're not becoming millionaires. And contradictory to what is in the paper and all the general philosophy and concept that as a government worker we're making too much money, I don't think so. In fact, I know we're not.
Sure, and let's talk about that for a minute, because recently the USA Today came out with an article stating that federal employees' pay was up again, and even went as far as to point out the pay of Veterans Affairs doctors. But really, a doctor in the VA compared with the doctor in the private sector doing the same job or a similar job, the pay is of no comparison, isn't there?
You're absolutely correct. If a physician who works for the Department of Veterans Affairs happens to make $150,000 a year, that is peanuts compared to what a physician in private sector makes. A physician who has his own clinic or his own doctor's office, they make so much more than that.
Sure. And the private sector doctors, obviously they are working to serve their patients, and that's great. But in the federal sector, these doctors at the VA are dealing with a very specific set of injuries. I'm thinking about PTSD or traumatic brain injury, things like that, that are very specific to wartime issues.
You're absolutely correct. And we have so many veterans who, here in the last 5 to 10 years, the VA has been focusing quite a bit on closed head injuries. You have an individual who joins the military, they go off to war, they come back, they appear to be okay, but they have closed head injuries. So the VA is specifically doing a lot of research and caring for those types of veterans, which is something that is not really focused on tremendously in the private sector. So we have a very specific mission. We have a very, very important mission, because all veterans have worked, have given up part of their life to their lives to protect our freedoms and the things that we enjoy here in this great country of the United States of America.
Sure, and some of these soldiers, when they come back, they may not have the physical injuries that some of the others do. I'm thinking, you know, like you said, some of these closed head injuries, and they may take a little time to develop, and they may not necessarily have a problem as soon as they get home. But 5 years down the road, the trauma that has been caused to them through a traumatic brain injury or a PTSD really starts to come to the surface, and that's when they really need that care from the VA to make sure that they're okay.
And that's exactly what we're doing. And you could compare that, I think, in the Korean War veteran, the World War II veteran, I think the condition was referred to as being, quote-unquote, shell shock. That's the common term, that the general layman's term, shell shock. Post-traumatic stress disorder is similar to that, in that, as you stated, it may not appear immediately upon discharge from the military, but sometimes later, years later, it can and does develop. We have quite a few veterans who have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, and the private sector is just not up on that type of treatment, that type of condition, as much as the Department of Veterans Affairs is. So we have a very specific mission. We have a very important mission. And we like what we're doing, and we really do hold the veteran in high esteem, and we need to remain, as the Department of Veterans Affairs, not have their care privatized. It would be the worst thing that could happen to the veterans. And like I stated, every person in this country is touched. Their life is touched by a veteran in some shape, form, or fashion, be it spouse, brother, sister, sibling, mother, father, grandfather. Every person in the United States of America's life has been touched by a veteran.
Fredna White, AFGE 10th District Women's Coordinator. Fredna, as always, thank you for your time.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you to our guests this week, AFGE 11th District National Vice President Jerry Swanky, 10th District Women's Coordinator Fredna White, Local 1812 President Tim Shamble, and Public Policy Director Jackie Simon. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Dell, and AV Technologies.